We're recording. All right, today is September 29th, 2021. This is an oral history interview with BJ Foreman. We are conducting this interview virtually over the phone, and we have two interviewers and one narrator. I am one of the interviewers. I'm Patience Stewart. I'm a historian, and I am calling from Portland, Oregon. We'll go to Kevin next.
This is Kevin Taylor. I'm a nuclear engineer and health physicist calling from Greenville, South Carolina.
And BJ, why don't you introduce yourself and let us know where you're calling from.
My name is BJ Foreman. That stands for Billy Foreman. I'm a retired, semi-retired INC engineer. I was stationed at Fort Greely, Alaska at the SM-1A nuclear power plant from August of 1969 to July of 1971. And I can relate my experiences there and my impressions.
We are looking forward to hearing it. Now, for the interview, as it's documented, would you like your name to be recorded as Billy or BJ?
You might list them as both with BJ in parentheses, because I might be difficult to find.
Okay.
Otherwise, there were so many Williams and Billies and Bills where I worked that the moniker on me was placed as BJ, and it kind of stuck for many years. And so I'm used to BJ, but after I've left that career, other people call me Bill or Billy. And so I kind of go by both. I'm very flexible in that area.
Okay. Will do. And what was your rank while you were at SM-1A?
I was a specialist E6. Army nuclear power program had originally planned for shift supervisors who were in charge of an operating shift to be ward officers, similar to the Navy. However, that didn't happen, and it turned out to be Sergeant E7 slots, Sergeant First Class E7 slots. And so one of my positions there at one time was the shift supervisor of an operating shift as an E6. And so it turned out that often in my Army career, I was working slots that were higher than what was on my sleeve. To give you an idea, it's a heavily trained slot. A little bit of background. I went to school for 2 years at Fort Belvoir to train for my job at SM-1A as both an operator and an INC maintenance person.
And how did you end up in the training program or elect to become part of this group?
Well, actually, getting off from the plan a little bit, but back up a little bit. I was at Kansas State University and majoring in nuclear engineering in 1965 and 1966. And we had a group that formed together for the nuclear engineers. And one of the fellows had been to the nuclear power plant program in Fort Belvoir. And so I put in for it. I submitted the paperwork to go to Fort Belvoir after I got out of Kansas State.
Great. Do you want to tell us about your training time there, or do you want to move into some of the technical information that you've prepared to share with us?
Well, you want to talk about technical training at Fort Belvoir, Virginia?
Sure. Yeah, if you want to tell us about your training program and your impressions of it.
Oh, my. Okay. That was covered on a previous interview, but to some extent. But, the training program there, I started in August of 1967, and I finished up in July of 1969. And, the first phase trying to recall, I think it was about 6 months, was an academic phase where you went through, you started out with math, simple arithmetic, and worked your way up and into being able to handle the computations and calculations that you have in later classes. And then you went through different classes taught by different people. Most of them were officers, and they had well educated in nuclear engineering or their specific fields, and they taught different subjects. I was very interested in nuclear engineering part, how to build a nuclear reactor, and we were tasked one time for homework to actually design and build a nuclear reactor. And so that's the end game that we did in the academic phase. The second phase was the operator training phase, which I really got into rigorous training over there in the SN1. It was in the same area, but it was in a different different building, of course. It was in the more secured area for the nuclear power plant that prototyped the SN1, which is actually the first nuclear power plant in the United States that put electricity on the grid. Trying to get that history correct. But you can see this on the internet. It'll pull up exact dates. They beat all the other plants. They were actually the first one that put out electricity on the grid to VEPCO, Virginia Electric and Power Company. But anyway, got some very extensive training there. And we trained on the floor as an operator that took hourly readings and identified different equipment and looked for different situations to maintain operations. And we were constantly starting up and shutting down and lighting up systems, and warming up main steam lines, and how to do it and how to stay safe. And not, to my knowledge, we never had an accident during my period. I don't know if they ever did have an accident there where somebody get hurt or break a leg or something. But it was very safe. And then we had, you took turns and you was in the control room for a shift, and you had different situations given to you. And I enjoyed bringing the reactor critical, enjoyed putting the plant online and paralleling in and putting electricity up on the grid. And one time I was probably the most tedious time was putting the backup diesel generator online with the nuclear power plant, because it was, the controls were very touchy. And I remember Mr. Smith was my shift supervisor training me, and he was very good. I really had some good instructors, and I wasn't prepared to elaborate on the SN1, but there's some information there that people could use. And then everybody was required to initially qualify as an operator, and that qualified you as an operator if you passed the tests at the end of the operating training phase. And then the third phase was you had to be selected and obtain a expertise and qualification in some sort of maintenance. It was either, you could either be an electrician, or you could be a mechanic, or you could be an INC person, which I was. I went into the INC training program. And or the fourth one you could be was a chemist combination health physicist, which is now, today it's called a radiation protection technician. And you learn both chemistry and health physics. I kind of skipped over a little bit. Before I even started, I got there in August. I don't think we started till later in the fall, September. But they put everybody into a room to many were deficit in academics, and they put everybody in a room and had them start doing math because that was the first class you had. And so 8 hours a day, everybody was doing math, but they because I came from Kansas State University, I think, I'm not quite sure, they didn't put me in that room. They put me down in the mechanic shop. And so before I even started the program, and I really enjoyed that as well because I didn't know anything about machine shop, and I was and the fellows taught me how to turn things down on a lathe. They taught me how to weld. They taught me weaving and anneal different metals, and I enjoyed that because I'd taken material science at Kansas State, and got to have, to me, it was just a big lab following my academics at the university. And so I enjoyed that very well, but I never spent any time at all in the room where they put people who came in early and got them doing arithmetic problems in a room to get them ready for the first math class. So, but anyway, it worked out. Academics was a breeze for me. The operations was very interesting and very rigorous. I can remember some times in the control room where 8 hours went by like 8 minutes. I did not take a break. We were so busy and they gave me so many problems that I really enjoyed it. Never complained and never said I liked it or never said I didn't like it. I was too busy. And I learned a tremendous amount at the control room, which later served me well at the SM1A. And then the INC program was started after about 12 months of academic and operation training. Then you started an INC program, which was the longest program, and it was approximately another 12 months. And so we learned a lot in class, particulars to nuclear INC instrumentation. And we also had labs available where we were tasked with problems in the lab and had to do things in the lab. So it was 2 years of excellent training. But anyway, that was pretty much my SM1 experience. And then at the end of SM1 experience, I got orders to go to SM1A.
Before we move to SM1A, could you just define for the recording what INC stands for?
Well, I'm sorry, I meant to do that. That's an acronym for Instrumentation and Controls. It's a common term in our industry and not so common once you get out of the nuclear power industry.
Okay. Thanks for doing that. Okay, well, why don't you tell us about your job once you got to SM1A?
Well, the first thing I did that was put into operations, we trained. You had to go out on the floor and draw every system, and you got tested for each system and quizzed. And then once you got all the systems done, you trained control room operator controls and got familiar with them, and then you got qualified all the way up through control room operator. And then I went to the INC shop to do maintenance. And later we did a engineering design change with Fort Belvoir Engineering and participated in that in depth. And then came back to operations and qualified as shift supervisor and a shift before I left. That's pretty much our training phase.
Sounds extensive.
I could bore you to death, or for somebody that's be interested, we could go into it more in depth. And I don't have all those documentation. I didn't pull out all the documentation and details exactly what we went into, but It should be available.
Sure.
Between people that's been there. I know one fellow put it out for a while. He worked for a international group up in near Washington, D.C. for a while. And he had a lot of documentation, the SM one, mm-hmm. and put it out for a while. And I don't know if he's still around.
Sure.
Like that was about 20 years ago, and I corresponded with him, and we didn't. There wasn't any central group. We were all hoping that the SM1 would become a museum, and we could funnel all of our information to one central location where it would be kept forever. But apparently, that didn't happen.
Yeah. We do have a copy of the training manual too, so that is something we have. But why don't we shift to Alaska and hear about your technical experiences at SM1A.
Okay, well, that's what I'd like to start with first, because to me that's probably more what people in Alaska would like to hear. They already know what it's like to live in Alaska, and I can cover my personal experiences and impressions last, but the technical information is probably what they're more interested in. So my whole family traveled to Alaska by car from Virginia. It's about approximately a 2-week trip. And with a wife and two kids and two dogs, that was an experience. The Alcan is 1,200 miles of dirt road, except for some paved road around Whitehorse, Yukon. But anyway, we got there in August in 1969, and we got some technical briefing as to where were we at. The plant was online, running smoothly, and they had a 1964 earthquake in Anchorage that did affect some degree Fort Greely, Alaska, which was 350 miles approximately from Anchorage. But it did have some effect on the plant. There was some concern about if it affected the spent fuel pit. So that was monitored and kept an eye on. And there was, and I found this to be true, that the 9-foot base in the containment building that housed the reactor components had actually unleveled itself. It was actually at a slight angle where a ball would roll across the floor. It wasn't steep and it wasn't really noticeable, but yes, it was not a level floor. And so that apparently was the result of the 1964 earthquake. There was two retirees that worked at the plant, and they retired, I believe, from the Army and came back as civilian workers in the plant, and they provided a lot of expertise. I think both of them were ex-mechanics. And one fellow gave us some stories of what happened in 1964. The plant was shut down during the earthquake, and he was the turbine guy that was in charge of turbine overhaul during an outage. They would take the turbine apart and do the maintenance on the turbine for shutdown, for the annual shutdowns. And he said there was a crane that they used that was not connected to anything. It was hanging loose, and the crane started swinging. And he thought that somebody was playing a joke on him. And so he started yelling at his workers that, hey, knock it off, this isn't funny. And the crane was swinging back and forth. And he didn't realize there was an earthquake at first. He was quite a fellow, and he's no longer with us anymore. I'd like to go ahead and mention his name. He was a pioneer, I think, in his own right, Jack Henderson. And he lived for a period of time in Alaska, and I think he later moved to the lower 48s for his final retirement. But anyway, that was turned over to us that, you know, we spied the earthquake and we were under the AEC guidelines then, and we got the okay to continue operation. And we that's where we were at. During the 1968, the year before we got there, there was another shutdown. And it was time to change the steam generators, one steam generator, and that was the first steam generator that was changed in a nuclear power plant, which is another historical event in nuclear power. And so the second, I believe, was in the Enterprise in 73, and then Surrey Power Station in 78. But anyway, just throw those numbers out there if somebody wanted research or further. But there's a lot of claims in the nuclear power industry, but these are the first plants in nuclear power plant history who actually should have the credit. The SM1A was the first steam generator change in a nuclear power plant that put electricity on the civilian grid. It was later, the steam generator was later taken in, I think, in 1970, 71. It was later hauled down to the Department of Energy facility in Washington State.
Hanford.
Now, the steam generator was a, it's not expected, of course, and so I remember that an Inconel sample was placed in line with the steam generator blowdown, and we monitored that as well. And I couldn't look at this piece of coupon, I guess they called it, and it never affected it. But we had changed the chemistry of our feed water, and we went to an EDTA chemistry, which I understood utilized in to chelate the chlorides and scavenge the chlorides and the oxygen. Again, I'm not a chemist. I'm an INC engineer, so it's a little out of my line, but I did take a lot of chemistry as in nuclear engineering curriculum, so I can relate some to the chemistry, but I don't claim to be the subject matter expert. So that's about as far as I want to go with explaining what was done with the chemistry. Somebody wanted to research that further. But we never had any concerns at all with the chemistry or damage to the steam generator. Of course, it was a brand new steam generator. And then during 1968, during that period, they also, at that plant, we were told, annealed the pressure vessel in place with nuclear heat, and it doubled the lifetime of the pressure vessel, and as recognized and approved by the Atomic Energy Commission. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission did not come into play until 1972, so we were under the inspection and surveillance of the Atomic Energy Commission, who would come out periodically. They would come to our plant to inspect. We, as an INC person, we would also monitor our neutron instrumentation wells on the outer part of the reactor for any leaks or water. And I remember there was some concern about that during an outage when I was there, and we did not find any water. I think we had to change a detector that was getting weak, but there was no water, to my knowledge. Apart from there was condensation all throughout the inside of the containment. It was quite humid, but not a leak. So anyway,
could,
Well, one other thing that we were briefed at when we came on site in 1969 was that there was some contamination outside of the plant in a dry creek bed, and it was marked off, and signs were put up, and a steel cable was around it to prevent people from going in. And I never found that area. I looked for it one time. Other people did. They knew exactly where it was at. But a decision was made that we couldn't do anything about it at the time. Apparently, we were not funded to clean up or have a company come in and do it, or have the Corps of Engineers do it. But it was well known, and to my knowledge, was well published. And then later on, when I left the military, I saw it on the internet as if a big surprise. Well, it really wasn't a big surprise. It was well known, and plenty of people knew about the contamination, but it wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't migrating, and we were to keep an eye on it, and somebody was going to monitor it, but there wasn't any funds to clean it up, which later I think did clean it up, and that part should be on the internet. But what I did not find on the internet that was well known prior to whoever wanted to say that they found it. Well, it was well reported and well known before that, back in the 60s. But anyway, you know, that's out of my line again. I'm not a radiation technician. But we just knew about it as an operations type information. That there was a contaminated creek bed, and the decision was let it set for now until the funds became available or whatever was decided later. But that was about about all the briefing that we got when we first got there. Aside from the weather conditions, we got there the 1st of August, and we had snow flurries. And we had Christmas songs on the radio. My wife didn't really want to go. She never really complained. She never complained once at all, but I don't think she really wanted to go to Alaska. And so that was quite a introduction to come into a state where in the middle of summertime, you got snow flurries and Christmas songs. But anyway, I'll get into that on this second part, and when I get into more personal impressions, we immediately commenced to learn the, just like the SM-1, we immediately commenced to start learning the plant as equipment operators, and we're tasked to go system by system and draw for ourselves every component, every valve, every piece of pipe of each and every system, one by one. And so when we did that, we were tested and qualified for each system, and then eventually became qualified as a floor equipment operator. And then the second qualification was control room operator. We had to qualify as a control operator, learn all the controls and all the procedures involved with operating the plant. And that was within a 6-month period, as I recall. And then I was sent to the instrument shop for about a year. But during the operations phase, there was some uniqueness probably to that plant that I haven't seen in other plants. We actually took calorimetric readings at the turbine throttle valve location. We could actually measure the steam, and we could calculate and figure out, you know, what the quality of the steam was, and the steam was very good quality. In fact, it went off scale and it became superheat. And we were operating with a 2 to 3 degrees superheat at the turbine. And we also provided not just electricity for the post and electricity for the surrounding community, civilian community, up to our maximum output. We also provided heating steam for the post, for all the buildings, for the military operations, and all the residences. There was approximately 500 people, to my knowledge, that lived there on post, and the heating steam to each one of the buildings came from our plant. We also provided steam to a laundry, which I was involved in, and there was some concern about trying to monitor how much steam they were using so they could be charged for it. Apparently, I'm not quite sure. I'm not in the in that accounting business, but as an INC technician, I remember going out to the laundry and calibrating the flow meter. And the flow meter was a very classic Ladeau Bell meter. These are classic instruments that are many years old in their design, the tried and true pieces of equipment that probably never see again. You'll never see that again. I was kind of amazed by something that was invented many years ago, but it was used for calculating and recording how much flow that the laundry actually used. There was some uniqueness in the plant. I never worked operations again after that, but I can remember one of the systems was a water treatment system where we had to, the first step, we had to gather up all the water that the tanks would contain, because once we started regenerating the water treatment system, we were not making water. And so the water is being used and started draining down. And we not only provided water for our plant, we provided water for the plant adjacent to us, which was a backup plant for both electricity provided by diesel generators and boilers that stayed hot all the time, 24/7, that were ran by civil service people. They were actually civilians who worked for the federal government. And so we provided their water as well in case they needed to pick up the load, or we had to transfer the load to them. Or I can never remember a time when we was ever overloaded. We always was able to provide our primary customer, which was Fort Greely. And then any excess, we were able to provide for the civilians, which they really appreciated and paid us well. Any kind of expertise in Alaska back in the 60s was much in demand. If you were a welder or a mechanic, or you made electricity, you were very welcome because it was very much needed. And so we accommodated, and we made electricity, and we made steam. But reading my notes here, I wiped out one page at the end of one page, switched mm-hmm. over to another one here.
Sure.
What impressed me, I guess, during an outage, and I was in a control room then, we had nuclear engineers come up from Fort Belvoir to help us on a refueling. The nuclear engineer, they were qualified nuclear engineers, but we had to pull the control rods and follow their directions, what we needed to do. And we did, during an outage, and you put new fuel in, you want to drop one rod at a time and and calculate its rod worth. It's a common thing with all nuclear reactors. Before you go critical, is you want to find out how much rod worth each rod has. And we did hot rod drops where the temperature of the reactor coolant was near operating temperature, and then we did cold rod drops, which were much colder. And it really impressed on me how much more reactivity was in the rod was presented at the colder temperatures. It was much higher rod worth when the water was colder. And that led me to my theory that was the main problem at the SL1 back in the 1960s, which we talked about earlier with Kevin, that water was, if you dig into those records, at that time of that accident, the water was near freezing, 32 degrees is near its flash point. And that was the maximum that rod worth would be at. So any slight movement had a tremendous amount more effect than it would at higher temperatures. But anyway, let me get back to SM1. I just want to point that out, but this is some of the things, these lessons learned, that served me well later, that I was able to pick up on later in my line of work. Steam was, as I said, was used throughout the post, and they had a unique flow meter that I'll probably never see again unless it's in the Smithsonian. But what impressed me, I want to impress how safe we operated, is they don't really do this today, to my knowledge. I really haven't seen it in the commercial plants. But we had a main steam line that was tapped off to be used for the post. For one of them, I think, we had a separate line that was used for the post or for the laundry, but it had a pressure reducing valve to drop the pressure down to where it wasn't a high pressure steam. And just before that valve was a small pinhole leak, and a small amount of steam was coming out of the pipe. And the plant superintendent was a NCO, non-commissioned officer, but he immediately had us shut down the plant, and so to repair that leak. And it was just a small leak, but he was very cautious, and we never had any accident in the plant. So when I was there, there was nobody got hurt, nobody fell down, nobody broke a leg while they were in the plant. And so that really impressed me, how safe we operated, that any kind of challenge that was unusual led to immediate shutdown, because we had a plant right next to us run by the civilians. They could take our electrical load and could take our steam load if need be. I ran into plants later that they were not necessarily using superheat, but there wasn't as much concern about a steam leak. A steam leak is just avoid it and avoid the area until we can get to the shutdown period. It wasn't a cause for an immediate shutdown. We did have one fellow break his leg that volunteered for skiing lessons. There was a Arctic Test Center that was located at Fort Greely, and so he volunteered to go with the infantry people to go out in the middle of winter time and sleep outside and learn how to ski. And he was pretty much an outdoorsman. I think he ended up breaking his leg because of the skiing accident. Mm. because they not only learn how to ski on the bunny slopes, they actually get out into more challenging areas and a little bit too much too fast, especially if you're not an infantryman. We were very technical people, but we were not your combat type orientated people. And so, but he wanted to get that adventure, get that experience. And so I don't know all the particulars, but that was the only one that I could think of that ever happened, which was not in the plant. We had a General Electric turbine that sink speed ran at 5,700 RPM. We had a Westinghouse generator. And towards the end of my tour, following operations phase, instrument INC shop maintenance phase, and refueling outages, rod drops, and we had an engineering change design that we did. At the end of that, and I was gave notice that I would like to leave the military, they gave me the Army Commendation Medal out of the clear blue sky for my work in with the INC design change that we did. I'll talk about that in a minute. Didn't mean to skip over it, but just followed my notes here in order. And this was July of 1971. I was getting ready to leave, and we were shut down, getting ready to come back online, and we found out that the brushes in the main generator needed to be fixed. And people were turning over. People came there just before I did. Their 2 years was up, and they went back to the United States, the continental United States. And so we didn't have the leaders that we had before. We didn't have the electrical supervisor. We didn't have the maintenance supervisor, mechanical supervisor. And we didn't even have a lot of the leaders had already recycled back. A lot of new people came in. And the NCO at the time changed over, and he was in the evening, and there wasn't a whole lot of people there, but we needed to get back online, and we found that the generator brushes needed to be changed. And so he grabbed me and he says, "You're in charge of the maintenance department." I said, "No, I'm just a fellow that's getting out of the Army." "No, you're in charge of the maintenance department. You're the leading person here. You're the leading ranking person right now on shift. And we got people here, and we need this generator exciter brushes changed." So I'm an INC control person, control technician. That's my expertise. I never trained for high-powered electrical equipment like high-voltage motors and high-voltage breakers and main generators. And so I don't have the training, and I don't feel qualified, but you're in charge. And so this young fellow that came in, had just recently came in, his name was John Scalani. He's not with us anymore. And he impressed me as an electrician and knew his stuff. And unbeknown to me at the time, he had previously in his civilian life been a machinist. I said, "John, I really need some help, and this is out of my expertise. Is we got to get these main generator exciter brushes changed." He says, "Yeah," he said, "I can do it." He says, "Get the operators to run the turbine at 1,000 RPM and constant, and we got to polish down the existing shaft." He said, "I got to check with one of the mechanics how to uncouple something on it." And so he ran and did that. Came back and we got the shaft polished up, and John got the new exciter brushes on there very satisfactorily. And so that was, throughout life, you got somebody that is available in your life to save your bacon. And I often thought about that. And I ran into John before he passed away, and he stayed in the military and made it a career. And he became a warrant officer and ended up in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And we had a convention down there, and I ran into him accidentally. And he filled me up. John, I didn't want to get away from technical, but John was an outdoorsman, and he did a lot of hunting, and he shot a lot of wild game while he was in Alaska, and he had these different heads of different animals in his house mounted on the walls. But he was exactly what the doctor needed. He was at the right time and right place to provide. And somehow these people, like John Sclaney, appeared at the right time and had the right expertise and was the right answer to get the jobs done on time. Didn't mean to jump ahead. I wanted to also talk about the project that I worked on, and that was on or about June of 1970. Is the NUS company, I think they're called, that's an acronym for Nuclear Utility Service. I think they're still around. They were 20 years ago. But they came out with a design, and the number on it was 504. And that design was to create the capability for nuclear power plants to test the instrumentation, that tripped the reactor, online. You could test it every month online to ensure reliability that this equipment will work whenever it's supposed to, and prove it every month. And we was able to create two trains of instrumentation that had reactor trips, and we could take one train out at a time and periodically test it, and then put it back in service, switch that train over to operate, continue operating, and take the other train out of service and test it, and then switch it back to have a one out of two coincidence. You only needed one train to trip. Later on in the commercial plants, that evolved to two out of three coincidences and three out of four coincidences. And so it evolved into more design changes, but that was the first nuclear power plant that allowed for periodic testing at power of reactor instrumentation. To my notes here. It was even more extensive than what we got today. Today, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it's actually just a few years later, the 1970s, when we built a lot of the commercials, allow for periodic testing for downstream of the sensors. You don't have to test at the sensor level. And then you're allowed to calibrate, test your sensors during refueling outages. Well, this design at the SM1A actually tested at the sensor level, and the sensors were located outside of the containment, and the tubing and piping penetrated through the containment wall and through the pressure transmitters, and to protect for any accidental leakage, they had excess flow check valves. It was kind of new on the market, I believe, and they worked very well. They were just a ball valve that only moved when there was a flow. So if there was any flow in the tubing or piping, then it would check itself and not flow anymore. And was able to apply pressure to the sensor that provided reactor trip protection. In order to do that, we had to bring in bottles of air, and bottles of air got depleted because the pressure trips were upwards close to the value of the tanks. So you could get a 3,000 PSI bottle, or you can get a 6,000 PSI bottle. But the local fire department on their own base, they only had the capability to fill my tanks to 3,000 PSI, and that's what I did. And we had to purchase and change out 6,000-pound bottles whenever we needed that pressure. But I noticed, technical side, that in the middle of winter time, I would take my tanks down to the fire department, and they would charge up to 3,000 or 3,100 PSI, and the temperatures would drop down to 65 below zero. Even in the room where we tested, was very cold, and the pressure, without even using the tank, the pressure would drop. So if you fill up the tank at 3,000 PSI at 70 degrees, you could expect it to drop down to 2,700 PSI in sub below zero weather. And that was kind of a impression on me that you had to account for that. But during these design changes, we did a lot of tubing work, a lot of piping work, valving work, and that served me well later on in the commercial field, the maintenance field, but for how to design properly and apply the right specifications to the right system. Another thing that impressed me in operations was we had to process our liquid waste. And we didn't really have, we had large tanks in the basement that we used to send our liquid waste and accumulate, but we didn't have a processor to process the liquid waste and reduce it down in volume. And so we got in a skid while I was there and mounted the skid. I think, Kevin, you asked about this skid. It was kind of a neat skid. It was a self-contained, almost a completely self-contained system where all we had to add was the steam line to it and the discharge line for the water that got demineralized. And this skid boiled the liquid waste and evaporated, and it condensed in an overhead condenser into fairly clean water within limits to discharge. And any solids got precipitated out in a 55-gallon drum, which once it got close to its maximum discharge shipping radiation level, then we bottled it up, canned it up, and shipped it out. And it worked very well. I was kind of impressed with that small system. And it was able to reduce our liquid waste inventory nicely. See, I've got something else here. A couple more technical things, and I'll switch to more personal. But when I was on shift, and I had a shift supervisor that was in charge of me, he taught me to stay busy. He taught me, there was maybe four or five crews, depending on how many people we had, rotating shifts 24/7. But he taught me how to stay on top of everything that you looked at. And when the tank levels started getting depleted, go ahead and top them off and fill them up back up to their normal levels. Don't let them go all the way down to their alarm limit. And take care of things before they're required to. And that was kind of a new philosophy in that time. And later on in the commercial field, it got adopted. And the philosophy later on became, you really need to stay on top of all of your equipment on an operating shift, and keep them at optimum operating levels and temperatures and flows, and don't let them degrade. Bring them back to operating levels, and because if you have something happen that needed your attention, then your attention, you could put all of your efforts into that, and you would not be pulled away from a tank that required you to stop everything you're doing and fill it. And so if you kept the tank at an operating level instead of letting it drift downwards into its low-level alarm, then that's one less concern you would have when things needed your attention that were more important. And that served me well. I thought that was very commendable. That was his philosophy, and he passed it on to me. His name was Lester McNeil. He's no longer along with us either, but he stayed the rest of his life in Alaska. Had a family there. The other thing I want to talk about, last thing I want to talk about on the tactical field is during refueling, how it impressed me. I wasn't directly involved with field movement. I was more of a support area. The NCO in charge put me into the maintenance mode, where I would support them anything they needed for communications and for anything else that came up. And I was able to get around and see more rather than have to stay in one spot like many had to. And I observed the inspector. One fellow was charged with inspecting the new field, and the new field was in a locker room. And he would take out one fuel assembly at a time and put it under ultraviolet light and do a last minute inspection before it went into the reactor with cotton gloves. But he could handle the new fuel with his hands. It was not radiated yet. And even though it had, it was highly enriched uranium-235 for the military reactors. It was you were able to you were safely handle it as long as it wasn't radiated yet. And later on, that served me well when I had to work in commercial plants with plants before they, while they were being built and before they were radiated. I knew where the safety concerns were and where they were not to be a concern. Not everybody knew that, and that kind of surprised me, but the experience paid off. In the military experience paid off well in the commercial area. We built some very good plants in the commercial area because of that. The last thing I want to talk about, I guess, was the volume control tank. What we were operating did increase its radiation level, and so we could accommodate that with our rules and regulations inside the plant, but outside the plant we're limited to 100 MR per year at the fence, at the security fence where the public starts. And so the levels kept increasing where they would challenge that reading. So we took 55-gallon drums and stacked them up on the outside along the wall and filled them with water to moderate the gamma rays coming from the volume control tank. And still radiation levels kept going up. And so in the middle of wintertime, it was necessary to move the fence. Fortunately, we had Corps of Engineers from Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks come down and help us with their equipment. They could bore holes into the solid ground at 60 below zero weather and put in new posts and move the fence out for us. So we really didn't have that work on our hands to do firsthand, but that's how we solved the problem with keeping the limits, the public limits, down within its range. Well, that about wraps up all the technical things that I had. I've got some more personal things I could talk about if that's desired. What my impressions were of Alaska.
Sure. Kevin, do you have any technical questions for BJ?
No, I don't. I think that was a very good rundown of your experience, BJ. I really appreciate it, and I think it's very valuable to keep that and to record that.
It's a very technical expertise that you brought to the plant, too. And, yeah, thank you for sharing. Please, we have some time. Go ahead and tell us about some of your personal experiences at Fort Greely in Alaska.
Yeah, this is preaching to the choir if Alaskan people are listening, because they know what Alaskan's about more so than I do. But we had Fort Greely was actually built during World War II, I understand, when they put the Alcan Highway through, and it was for the Arctic Test Center to train combat soldiers to provide defense for the United States in Arctic conditions. And Fort Greely definitely had them, even though it was in its southern part of Alaska. We got the Siberian winds from Siberia, and so it was in the 60s, not so much now, because I do check the temperatures occasionally, but the temperatures, the 2 years I was there, during the wintertime, got down to 65 below zero dry ball, and even more so with wind chill, because the wind could go as high as 50 miles an hour, and so that could bring the wind chill down even further. I had two small children. One was ready to start kindergarten, and the school, trying to remember, the school was about three blocks away, as I recall. So you could walk during this good weather, you could walk to the school. It'd be about three blocks from our townhouse. There was six townhouses, as I recall, for each building, and then there was three buildings in a U shape, and then immediately across the road was another three buildings, and then there was four rows of that. So that was approximately 144 townhouses at least. So we had approximately a community of 500 people, to give you an idea of our residency there at Fort Greely. It was quite comfortable once you got in the townhouse, but when we got there in August, everybody in the world seems to come in at the same time, which the best time to move around in the military, if you got children, is in summertime, so they don't have to be interrupted in their school during in the winter months. And so there was a lot of movement in the summertime, and there was no housing. So I reported in to the plant, and the NCO had assigned people who were already there were your mentors. You had everyone who was assigned a mentor to help you anything you needed. And so immediately all the housing was taken up on the post, and all the housing was taken up at Delta Junction, which is the small town outside of the post. So what do you do? Well, I was given, once again, I think God gives these people in front of you certain times of your life. And we were introduced to our mentor, who was a couple about the same age we were. Was, I like to mention their names. He's no longer with us again. Is Forrest Balding, and his wife was Rose Balding. And that they were ex-teachers before they came into the Army. Like, he was a chemist, I believe, or a health physicist. They worked in the same lab. And I don't think he ever went on shift, operating shift there at SM1A, but they were ex-teachers from Arkansas, just down-home folks. And they took us in like missionaries. And we got to sleep on couches or floors or whatever for the first night or so to get by until something opened up for us. And so they got to know our children, and our children got to know their children. And so that was kind of nice. It was kind of like, hey, we're out here in the remote area of Alaska, and we all got to survive and help each other. And I really appreciate those folks. Lost track of them, other than I found out that Forrest is no longer with us. And 6 months later, when my daughter was going to school, in the winter months, it gets very dark there. You get practically no sunlight at all during the winter months. Further, you're north of the Arctic Circle, it's 6 months of daylight and 6 months of darkness. But anyway, the bus will come up right to your doorstep. And when you have ice fog, you can't really see. And so it's dark. And you might be able to see a faint light of the bus lights. And you can hear very well. It's deadly quiet. But you can't hardly see, your hand in front of your face. And so my wife would walk the kindergartner daughter into the bus, make sure she got on. And then later in the afternoon, it might lighten up a little bit, depending on the time of year. But anyway, 6 months later, my daughter got off at the wrong house. And even though it's only two or three blocks, if you can't see the hand in front of your face and you're just a little kindergarten, you don't even know your way around and all the houses look the same, you're in trouble. And we're talking as cold as 25 degrees below zero before they shut the school down. So if it's 20 degrees below zero, and you got off the bus at the wrong house, and all the houses look together, and you're confused. You don't know where to go. It's a very dangerous situation. And Rose Balding happened to recognize my daughter. So she took my daughter in to her house and called my wife. And those are things you never forget. That was very personal to me, to help my family out like that. And those are the type of people that we ran into in Alaska, those type of people that we worked with in Alaska. Everybody helped each other and gave each other advice on what they knew, whatever they could provide, provided for others. We were not used to snow in August. That was just a light snowflakes. And weather changes rapidly in Alaska. During the summertime, it could be as hot as 75 to 80 degrees. You don't get very many days like that, but it does warm up and everything grows around the clock during the summertime. Very rapid growth. Wintertime, it's deadly quiet. And very different scenario during the winter time. But we, during the 2 years, we stayed busy. My wife stayed very busy. I worked at the nuclear power plant on shift work, very non-military atmosphere. We were more technical plant people trying to operate properly and provide the service and be safe. In fact, oftentimes I was given a jumpsuit, and you could change out of your uniform into a jumpsuit. You didn't even have to wear a uniform, and that was to keep from getting oil or staining your uniform. And that was an experience. You don't normally run into that in a military. But anyway, we stayed very busy. I worked also at a TV station that was on post, ran a military TV station that broadcast on one channel, it's a channel 6, and also worked at a TV repair shop, the old analog TVs, that was in need. Everybody needed some TV repair work. And any expertise you had in Alaska during that period of time was very welcome. Anything that you could do that was your scope, your talent or your skill, was very much appreciated. So one of the sergeants started a TV repair shop, and I worked for him to get the experience of electronic bench work repair. And I worked in the TV broadcasting station to learn how they did things there. I worked at the time, I was also trying to prepare myself for civilian life, and so I wanted to be marketable. And I also studied and took my SCC test. So we had to make a trip to Anchorage, Alaska for the test. And we made, and that was about 350 miles. We had to, we also made several trips to Fairbanks, which is about 100 miles away. Fairbanks provided a lot of entertainment. They had blanket toss, they had the gold panning, they had a lot of sights to see in Fairbanks. They were developing a city. We also made a trip to Valdez before the pipeline was installed. The pipes were there, they were stacked up in 1970, 1971. They were not installed yet. The permits were not approved yet. And so the large 48-inch pipes were stored and ready to go. And you could rent trailers in a trailer park down there for military could line up and rent some trailers to go fishing. And so I took the whole family down there, but they pretty much stayed in the trailer. They didn't really want to venture out pretty much because this was at the time was wilderness. And so I wanted to investigate the silver salmon who were running them, and these salmon work their way back upstream and fight the flow of the water in order to spawn further upstream. And so I wanted to see that and maybe do some fishing. So I took some fishing tackle, and the wife didn't want to go with me. So I found the stream and I started fishing, and I felt like something was behind me. And I looked around, and it was at least a 6-foot black bear behind me, standing up. This isn't cool because I didn't have a weapon on me. All I had was a fishing pole. And so my instincts kicked in, and the bear was between me and the car, and I'm by myself. And so I started wading directly into the water and then started working my way upstream. And the bear continued to sit on his hind legs upright and turn his head and watch me. This isn't a good feeling. But the bear didn't move. And so I worked my way a ways upstream and got some distance away from the bear. And then I started coming back inland and circling around and worked my way back to the car. And the bear apparently was hungry, fortunately. And I got out of his, I got away from his dinner. He could have all the salmon he wanted. And I got to my car. And that was another experience I don't think I'll forget. But you know, looking back on it, I wish I had a cell phone like we have today and could take some pictures. So I don't know if people believe me. But it was at least a 6-foot black bear. But I asked
DJ, I'm going to interrupt you there real quick. Just ask you, what did your wife say when you got home and you told her back to the campsite and you told her about the bear? Or did you keep that from her for a little while so she would remain comfortable where she was?
I don't recall. No motivation. Well, that's why I didn't go with you. But anyway, these things are some experiences that I'm not an outdoorsman, and so I didn't ever expect to experience these type things. I don't really want to put myself into that situation. But we saw a lot of wild game. We saw one time I was driving back to the post with my family, and we were driving on asphalt, heavily wooded area, and around curves. And during the summertime, the wind is down, and you can hear clop, 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 clop. It's like horses on pavement. And so we carefully, slowly came around the curve, and there's a large moose clopping down the highway. And he kind of looked at me like, what are you doing on my road? We had buffalo herds that periodically came through the area close to the post, and when they would come up on the post, the military police would go out and scare them off with clapping sticks together, making noise. But anyway, my daughter claims that the buffalo actually came up on the grounds on the school area where she was walking home one time. I don't know if that's a fact, because I never saw the buffalo on site, but the buffalo did, according to Les McNeil, it did come on site one time. He had to pull a night shift with the post commander's office. We had to provide people to man the post. I think I did it one time out of 2 years where you had to report to the post for the night shift and stay there to man the phones and to notify people whenever the general or the colonel left or came in. And that was about the only thing. It just maintained communications to the pertinent leaders throughout the post. And he was telling me one time, I'm getting this secondhand, but he was saying one time that he stepped outside because there was somebody else in the building. There's him and one other person in this building, and he stepped outside and the door locked behind him, and there was the buffalo. And the buffalo took out after him. And the buffalo could outrun him, but when he turned a corner, he would run around the building. And whenever he turned a corner, the buffalo could not turn as fast as he could. And so then he could outrun the buffalo and get ahead of the buffalo. But then on the long stretch of wall that he had to run, the buffalo started catching up with him again. And so meanwhile, he said he was banging on the windows trying to get the other fellow to open up. And it's a story that people laugh about, but I've always believed it was true. He was a very truthful man that I had no cause to doubt his stories. And so, yeah, the buffaloes were there, and when they separated from the herd, they would be individuals. I did remember one time driving down the highway, and the trees were a soft wood. I'm trying to remember what they were. I've been watching some Alaska shows and verified it was type of tree, but they were a soft wood. And I was driving along, and I saw it looked like all the trees were mashed down. It was a heavily wooded area, and all the trees were mashed down, like tanks went through there. But it wasn't any tank trails. The tank went through. It was on both sides of the road. It came in from one side of the road and crossed over and went on the other side of the road. Then I realized they had to be the buffalo that mashed down the trees, made their own trail through the woods. They might have stampeded or something, otherwise they would try to go around the tree. But if they stampede, they could easily take out the trees. But I didn't see that firsthand. But that was my theory, that buffaloes might have stampeded and mashed trees down like they were sticks. So they were very powerful animals. So was a moose. They were very powerful animals. I could tell you some stories that's in the Fairbanks News Miner that somebody could go back and research the Fairbanks News Miner, Navy News Miner, that was actually in the paper during that period of time. A couple of things that really impressed me was, one of them, during the wintertime, this moose could get into the permafrost or tundra, and they couldn't find support for their legs to get out of it, especially in deep snow. Some snow drifts could be several feet high. And so the whole herd would get bogged down and couldn't get out of an area, a valley or something. When the snow drifts came in and starved to death. And so on the front page of that Fairbanks newsletter was a woman in her backyard in Fairbanks feeding pancakes to a moose. And she said, he eats 15 pancakes a day. So she's cooking pancakes and hand feeding it to the moose. And so there was some uproar as to why the Alaska Fish and Game was not dropping hay from helicopters to drop hay on the herds so that they could survive. And the caption, I read through the articles, I recall, the Fish and Game claims that they would not eat the hay. Well, if they would eat the pancakes, I don't know why they wouldn't eat the hay. It's just puzzling to me. But another thing about the Fairbanks News Miner that can be researched and documented, it's already documented, was that the Intuits or the natives that became citizens in the 1950s, at least the babies became, the newborns became citizens when Alaska became a state. They lived in remote areas, and their food source was caribou. And so they would leave during the summer and go after the caribou herds and get their meat and fur and such, and do their hunting during the hunting season to prepare for the winters. Then they would go back to their home base, which was actually wood-built houses, and ordered the oil for heating to be delivered before winter. And they actually had an airfield where airplanes could bring in the oil, and they're expecting oil delivery. Well, blizzard hit as Alaska weather changes rapidly. And blizzard hit before the oil could get delivered and didn't let up, and snow drifts and such blocked off the airfield and their bulldozer. They had a bulldozer, but the bulldozer didn't work. The radios worked. They could call out their two-way radios, but the bulldozer didn't work to clear the airfield so that the regular planes could not land, so it pretty much had to be hauled in by helicopter, which the military had, the U.S. military had the helicopters. It was actually determined that it was the Air Force's responsibility. And so, so I was reading the article, and they said that it was, they were so desperate that they were all gathering in one house and tearing the wood off of the other houses to burn so they could have heat to survive the winter, and they still didn't have enough oil. They were desperate because they were going to run out of fuel by burning up pieces out of the houses and furniture in order to stay alive. And the Air Force said they could not respond because they had to wait for orders from the Pentagon. And the Canadian Air Force stepped in and flew the oil that they had purchased for their winter over to their home base. And so that always impressed me how the Canadians stepped in when our own military was too slow to accommodate. Apparently, that always bothered me. So maybe that's not politically correct, but that should not have happened. And hopefully those type things don't happen now or in the future. Better response times or better emergency procedures are in place. But, you know, I'm just a specialist E6 in a nuclear power plant in Fort Greely, Alaska. You're limited to what you can do at the time, but at least I can explain it now that those type things did happen. But anyway, I wanted to explain about my family trips, and my wife stayed busy as well. She was a Sunday school teacher in church there. And she, and I was on shift, so I didn't make church very often. But she also was, got involved with the Cub Scouts. Since the Boy Scouts at the time was required to have men, she couldn't qualify. So I helped her with the Cub Scouts, and we got literature and what games and what crafts to do. My wife's big on crafts. And so we often had meetings in our basement where we could do things and get things, make crafts and stuff for the scouts, and got to know the different families. And my wife also babysatted for people as well. So she got to know people more so than I did. I was pretty much restricted to people at the plant. It's about the only people that I knew. We were kind of our own fraternity. We still have conventions every 2 years. However, our numbers are dwindling. This is many years later. At least half of us are gone, and so. We, Fort Belvoir, Virginia, had all the land-based military plants involved. And so we also had the Navy and the Air Force people who were assigned to their, to maintain their nuclear power plants on land. The Navy had one and the Air Force had one at the time. So what we have done in recent years is for our conventions, we've merged together with the Navy guys. I think we have one just about every year. Predominantly, prior to that, the Navy had their own, pretty much all of them, even though both of us are invited to either one. We just don't know as many Navy people as we do Army people. And so... That's why I feel a little more at ease trying to throw out some names here of people that I work with in the Army. So I've known them for much longer time. But another thing that we did one time was going on the way to Fairbanks across several bridges, and one of them was Top River, I believe. and some other rivers. But one time we, with kids, you don't want to drive very far. You want to pull off and let them and the dogs exercise if you got dogs with you. And so we pulled off in the, on the riverbank, walking up and down the riverbank. It's an early spring. And there's all these different colored rocks were up on shore. And some of them were gold and mica and silver and jade. So we picked up boxes and boxes of rocks and got a tumbler and got involved with the lapidary hobby of polishing rocks, where you put the rocks into this cylinder and the electric motor dries it for a couple of days and nights, 48 hours straight, and the rocks come out sparkling in different colors. I was very interested in the different minerals that they had there. And I went to one time in Fairbanks. I wasn't sure what I had, so I purchased some different rocks that they're mounted in plastic. They're just a small piece of a rock, so you could tell the difference between real gold and fool's gold, or real jade, or silver and mica. Very interesting to a person who's taken material science. We had one mountain that was south of Della Junction called Rainbow Mountain. And we drove by it a few times, and the old mountain, when the sun hits it in the afternoon, there's many different colors. And so it got its name. One of the main reason we had a nuclear power plant at Fort Greely was initially the Army nuclear power program was to support a missile program. I'm trying to recall off the top of my head, I believe it was the Nike missile sites. And then it was before the plants were built, that was changed to support the district early warning system. And so that's what we did in Alaska. We supported a radar site. It was approximately 4 miles south of Fort Greely, and we drove by it occasionally. One time, when we came back from Anchorage at one time, it was in the summertime, and it was still daylight, even at 10, 11 o'clock at night, getting close to home. And so you got two kids that's ready for bed. And I came upon a valley, in a flat valley, And I saw snowshoe rabbits. They were maybe 5 or 6 abreast. And as far as the eye could see on one side, and as far as the eye could see on the other side, the rabbits, snowshoe rabbits, white, large snowshoe rabbits, moving an inch at a time. They were migrating across this valley, but they had to be miles long. I couldn't tell how long they were, but easily over a mile that I could see. And so, what do? It's late at night. I got a wife and two kids. I got dogs that need to be fed. I've got to get back home. And the rabbits, you know, they never saw a person. You can walk up to a rabbit in Alaska during the 60s. They just look at you. I mean, they've never seen a human before. They have no fear of a human because they cannot identify. You're not threatening to them. And so I couldn't get the rabbits to do anything. They were locked in, locked step. They were to follow the rabbit in front of them, and they're not going to move out of your way. So I hope I'm not censored for this or arrested, but I put it in gear and I drove over the rabbits. And to this day, the wife doesn't let me forget that. She said, "You drove over the rabbits. You killed those rabbits." Looking back, I don't see how I had any choice. I couldn't move the rabbits. I could not wait for another day for the rabbits to go by. I couldn't stay in the car and expect my family to stay there all night. But anyway, we killed some rabbits. I drove over the rabbits. And so they just would not get out of the way. no matter how slow, how much noise you made, or how much, how slow you went, they did not get it. They were not going to move. But what? Anyway, yeah. That's Alaska, and I'd seen worse. But I figured, well, that's it's a circle of life in ecology. The one plant or one animal is there for another's food source for another plant or animal, and it's a full circle. And so I figured, well, there's going to be a need for this food source from another animal, and so buzzards or birds are prevalent, and it will serve its purpose. But that's me. I was born and raised on the farm, and we had to kill. I had to kill chickens myself, and I observed the killing of pigs and our cows. We too much for us. We took those into the slaughterhouse and let them do the cut up the meat and such. But I was used to required butchering of livestock in order to have a food source. But you know, my wife never let me forget that. So that's kind of a family joke. It humbles me to this day that I did something you didn't want to do, but you had to make a decision and do it.
What an interesting sight, though, to see that migration. Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to tell BJ that I apologize, but I've got to drop off the call. But it certainly was good to hear his stories, and again, I certainly appreciate the information him sharing with the his stories back on SM1. I enjoyed speaking with you back then and hearing these stories as well. But I apologize for having to drop off. I do have another meeting I have to get to. So, patience. Thank you. I'm sure you'll wrap this up.
Sure.
Thanks a lot, BJ. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin.
You got 99% of it. I'm just about. I think one more item to cover. That's about it.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening.
Sure.
But anyway, yeah, I wish I could. I didn't do a dry run on this, so this is all kind of cold. I just try to chop down a few notes by memory. And one other thing I wanted, personal note I wanted to point out that we weren't used to is we had two dogs. We kept them in the basement for most of the time as the harsh winters. And then summertime, we required to have a chain outside. But the school children teased the dogs if they walked by. Knowing they were on a chain, I guess. So most of the time we kept our dogs inside, and then we would take them out for a walk and let them run in the middle of the night. So they normally came back. But one time, one of the dogs did not come back. And it might not have been able to find its way back because all the houses looked the same. You had at least 144 townhouses. And so we thought we lost the dog. And then a couple days later, the dog showed up, and it had porcupine quills all up and down, all throughout the dog. We had to pull out these porcupine quills out of the dog. But the dog never ran away again. But anyway, I'm looking through my notes. I think I've covered just about everything. That's about all the personal things that have happened to me during the last week.
It sounds like it was a very interesting couple of years up there, and definitely an adventure.
Yeah, we were at the base of the Denali National Park, and when you look out of the kitchen window, we could see three mountains, Deborah, Hess, and Hayes. And even during the summertime, you could see the snow-capped mountains. And it was a very pretty sight, very pretty during the summertime. Very harsh winters. The winters were extremely hard, and I never understood cabin fever until I was there, and I could understand why a person could get cabin fever. But my wife stayed very busy with the church and Cub Scouts and crafts and worked with different people throughout the post. And she knew a lot more people than I did. She got around and babysat for people. And so it was an interesting trip. I don't know if I want to live there, but I wouldn't mind visiting during the summer. It's very pretty and warm. I'm a warm-bodied animal. I don't really enjoy cold weather. I don't mind a month or two, but 9 months, 8 or 9 months of darkness is not for me. It's like for 6 months of darkness. It's not for me. I stayed busy. I was busy all the time too, which now I'm not. Now I'm more semi-retired, and so I've got more time on my hands. I don't have as much energy as I used to have, but I don't need to work long hours like I did. I felt like I had to work long hours and provide for my family, which I guess every family man is under that feeling that you got to provide for your family is one of the most important things you got to do. But yeah, there's one thing in my life that I always wanted was a full life. I wanted adventure. I wanted a family. I wanted the education. I wanted the military experience. And I pretty much got it. God's been good to me, and I've traveled. I lived in Southeast Asia. I lived in Europe. I've traveled in the Middle East. I've lived in Alaska. I lived in Florida. I've lived in California. I lived in Georgia. I've traveled throughout the United States and traveled several other continents and lived there, whereas that was my address for a number of years. And so I've fulfilled pretty much what I've done in my life. It goes very quickly. It goes much quicker than what you realize, because at the time you think you got all the time in the world, but then when you leave that area or you leave that place, you realize you'll never have this experience again. You'll never see some of these people again. You'll never be able to interface with the people again or see the area again. I didn't talk about the Northern Lights. We did go out and see the Northern Lights. My wife wanted me to see it, and she was really excited about it. I didn't see different colors other than the blue-green. I did see the blue-green lights, and they did move and around. And then I also wanted to test out what I heard about taking a glass of water and pouring it at waist level in the wintertime, and it was 60 degrees below zero, 65 degrees below zero. And I went outside and I got a glass of water and walked outside with it and poured the water waist high. And by the time the water hit the sidewalk, it was shattering into ice. So that's true. That was a true statement. I did that firsthand. And yes, they do have Northern Lights up there during certain periods of time, certain periods of the year. It's not predictable as far as I know. You can't really predict, okay, tonight we're going to have some Northern Lights. You just know it's that time and the conditions are right, and you have to periodically check and see if the Northern Lights are appearing. And sometimes they will and sometimes they won't. So, but anyway, it was an experience. I kind of enjoyed the experience, enjoyed the time there. But it's not an area that I want to live in. I'm more of a I have to have access to resources. I was born and raised, and my wife also was born and raised in Kansas. And so whenever we go back there, it impresses me how quiet and peaceful Kansas is compared to the East Coast. It's East Coast, it kind of wears you down when you're around traffic and noise and a lot of people. And when you go to another area like the Midwest, where it's just beautiful area, nice valley. I went out last June. I went out to see my family, and I was struck. I have to fly into major airport to major airport, so I flew into Kansas City, which is a 3-hour drive to my hometown. And I'm driving along this highway, a huge, beautiful highway with paved side areas and all flat areas you can see for miles. And there's no traffic, no noise, no traffic, just beautiful countryside. It's like, where's everybody at? I'm used to bumper traffic and noise and sirens and helicopters flying over and all kinds of activities, but just so nice and peaceful in the Midwest. If that's what you want to live day by day, fine. It's nice. It's peaceful. I prefer both. I prefer having resources close by to access. I prefer having residence where you can reasonably escape from the noise and the traffic and rest up and rejuvenate. So I kind of have both in Virginia. However, Virginia is becoming more and more heavily populated. But that's where we're at. That's pretty much wraps up what everything I remember off the SM1A. It was as well as SM1, you could almost call it a prototype of sorts. We did a lot of unique things there that I hope these plants get the credit in history books. They were the first in many things, especially the SM1. I later went on to work for Virginia Electric and Power Company, and people were wanting to claim certain things about the commercial industry, for example, the security. And SM1 had excellent security. And I was always impressed with, never knew the guard's name. He always knew my name. Whoever it was, there's different people. They always knew my name. And they always had a radiation dosimetry for me with my name on it. And they always had a smile and a cheerful, good morning, sir, to me. And I always remember that, always appreciate that. Something that has gone by the wayside, I think. We just don't have the down-home connections that we did in the past. But that's me, because I come from the West, which is the more friendly folks. I lived in California for a while. They were also friendly people. And to this day, I think they're still there. And once you have what happened in California is in the 1930s, a lot of Midwesterners had to leave for the Dust Bowl when they had to go out to California. And they were people who needed to make a living. They had to pick the vegetables and the fruits, and they had to do their skill set, which was agrarian business. But they had a friendly personality, and that personality spread, and then you had an influx of Asians and Hispanics, but the personality seemed to pass off to other cultures that they might have had, especially the Asian people, their culture is very polite and cordial people anyway. And so, but it seems that, and the Hispanics, many of them are polite and cordial and hardworking people. And but it, that culture started by, I have to give the Midwesterners the credit, to be polite and courteous to your people. I was in San Francisco last time. It was catching, making a connection on the BART system, which you can look at the map and figure out which line you pick to go where you're going. And one fellow came up to me and asked me if I needed any help. It's like, you know, that's a friendly gesture. So, and this is a large city, and here you got like a small town atmosphere trying to help each other. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I kind of miss. We don't really have that in the big city. There's just too much crime, too much misunderstanding. So I think a lot of it is misunderstanding. A lot of it is we're all trying to do a common goals and common things. And if we could communicate better, I think is one of the major problems we have. You realize the other person has got the same goals you do. They may come from a different culture or a different approach to it. And there's no need to be at each other's throats, because you're both trying to support the same goal. And so I think that's what we're missing today in today's society, and on the East Coast anyway.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives. I think we should probably go ahead and wrap up the interview. It is really interesting talking with you and just hearing your journey as you connected your training and then your time at SM1A and then, your perspectives about your time in Alaska and then just how it's carried you through your life. And we really appreciate your service to the program, to SM1A, to the country. And then it sounds like also just your kindness as a human being. So I appreciate that.
Okay, yeah, I don't know if anybody's interested too much in the personal aspect, but yeah, I'd really like to support the technical history of these plants. They really deserve their story to be told and preserved. And some people were pioneers, of course. It was always a team effort. Whenever somebody would come up with an idea, it took a team to implement it or to perfect it or to fine-tune it. And so it's always a team effort, no matter what. But anyway, that's my story, and that's where I sat. And I've been blessed with good health and long life, so I look forward to some good years left yet. But I enjoyed I've got a large family myself, and I came from a large family, and I look forward to some golden years left yet.
Sounds like they're well deserved.
Well, thank you.
All right, I will be in touch with you after the interview. There's a release form for the university that's headed your way. And then we can talk a little bit about a bio for the website.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, I. Do you need any more in-depth information, or?
No, I don't think so. I think we'll put something together and work with you offline to just do a short bio about who you are and the time that you were at SM1A. It'll just be a couple of sentences.
I can scratch around. In the 60s, we didn't have cell phones, or we had still cameras, and we did take a lot of pictures, so I can We capture them in scrapbooks, and I've got a bookcase filled with scrapbooks. And we got away from that, and we do more cameras and digitized pictures, and just store them on digital media. But I can scratch around and look to see if we got any pictures. Are you more interested in technical pictures or humane pictures of personal families in Alaska?
I think more pictures that show the building and the plant itself or any of the operating equipment. I mean, there can be people in them, but definitely photos that are focused on SM1A.
Yeah, I don't think I took any of them. I'd be surprised if I get any pictures of this. It's just something that we were cautious about because of security and classification, even though there really wasn't any.
Sure. That makes sense.
I remember taking a friend up to the spent fuel pit one time, showing him the blue Surenkov glow, but I didn't take any pictures of it. And since then, other reactors have been publicly available with the Surenkov glow, the blue glow that the spent fuel puts off from the gamma radiation underwater, and so there's plenty of pictures of that, but I don't recall, other than my profile picture, when one guy wanted to take a picture of me in the control room, and he did, and I got a copy of that, and later on I put it on Facebook as my profile picture with a little bit of explanation.
Okay. Yeah, that photo is fantastic.
That'd be about the only picture that I can think of that was SM1A offhand. I'm trying to think. I can't think. Can't think of the pictures. Now, Charlie Harmon probably has them. He's been storing. You know who I'm talking about, Charlie Harmon?
Yes, he gave us your contact information.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He should be able to provide more official release pictures without embarrassing anybody, especially the DOD. We don't want to embarrass anyone. But anyway, I hope I didn't embarrass anybody otherwise. But that always bothered me that the Fairbanks Newsliner would, and then that was well published that there was some Native Americans that were stranded in a wilderness in a blizzard and couldn't get any help from the American military. That really bothered me. And the moose was stranded out in the valley. Of course, I'm one to talk for killing rabbits. We didn't have the PETA back in those days. We didn't have, in fact, I only saw one Alaska State Trooper one time in 2 years. And she was in Delta Junction as a woman, and she was in Delta Junction in the car, and she stopped for some reason and got in the car and drove off. That's the only time I ever saw any law enforcement in our area, in the Delta Junction area, in 2 years. And then when I was driving to Anchorage, I was listening on the radio, and so once we got away from Delta Junction, there wasn't any signal. So I needed something to keep the kids busy and entertained. Some of the things I tell them, they kind of wore out. So we were driving up there, I told them, you look at the snow on the top of the mountains, that's where the ice cream comes from. So once we got close to a glacier, my daughter said, "Dad, that's not ice cream. It's snow." But they, for a long time, they thought it was ice cream. But once halfway between Delta Junction and Anchorage, about 150 miles, was an area that's it's called Glen Allen. And Glen Allen had a radio station, and it was 100% in their language, in the Indian language. I can't remember if it was Alu or what Indian language it was in, but you could listen on the radio, and it was a completely different language on the radio. So that was kind of interesting, because you knew that you were not in Kansas anymore.
Sure thing. Okay, BJ, I'm going to go ahead and conclude the interview and stop recording.
Okay, I hope I told you enough.